This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a big week in the news. Our panel of trumpet writers is eager to discuss it. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Thanks for having me.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also from our office in Britain this week, Brent Noctegal.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So last night, America did it after Syrian dictator Bashar Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. On Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump launched America's first direct assault on the Assad regime in the 6 years that the civil war has been going on there. Obviously, it's very early. We can't know exactly what's going to happen in the immediate future, but this really could mark a turning point for Syria and help fulfill some biblical prophecies we've been talking about for quite a long time. For this, we're going to turn to our Middle East analyst, Brent.
Yeah, so quite a interesting situation where Mr. Trump acts very decisively. He issues his threat straight after he sees this attack, chemical attack. He sees children writhing in pain after it looks like suffering some type of nerve agent. Comes out on Wednesday in a joint press conference with the king of Jordan, King Abdullah, and he says that his attitude towards Syria and Assad has changed very much. This comes just after a week where his government said that it looks like Assad's going to stay. And yet he sees this act and he says, well, you know, when I see babies, little babies that are killed with lethal chemical gas, then that's a red line for him. And he acted that, what was it? I guess it was a day and a half later, just last night, launching from around 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles from the Eastern Mediterranean that struck the airfield that the United States believes sent these bombers into the sky, these jets into the sky that dropped the chemical weapons.
Obviously, pretty dramatic in terms of making headlines this morning. But what has been literally the damage that they did there?
Well, it doesn't look like there were too many deaths involved, perhaps just around less than 10. Some of the jets were destroyed, some of the Syrian jets. Also, most of the hangars and such were destroyed. I believe one of the airstrips is still operational. But this was the decision. It was a very targeted strike. That was the point. This might not be the situation where he is against Assad, Mr. Trump, but that he is against the use of chemical weapons. That is the red line. And he struck the very source of those chemical weapons.
It seems like, given the nature of the atrocity, that this is definitely something that a lot of people, even Trump's critics, would be supportive of. And it seems like that's really what we're seeing, not only from within the United States, but other nations as well, within Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've talked a lot about it, Mr. Trump's seeming disapproval, at least, well, the disapproval of the Europeans for Mr. Trump and his policies over the first few months of his presidency, yet they all seem to be backing him on this. UK, Germany, France, Italy, European nations that have come out in support of what Mr. Trump has done. You could add to that Australia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, other Arab states are in support of this. Of course, you have the notable exceptions of Russia, China, Iran, that are not for such actions, at least that's what they're saying. But yeah, you've got international support for Mr. Trump against what is just a horrific act. I mean, anyone looking at the footage, seeing the footage of children that are gradually, slowly dying, that motivated Mr. Trump to act in this way, and he seems to have the approval of much of the world.
Now, we are talking about, like you said, very limited strikes that, in one sense, it seems like they're sort of directly retributive against that specific act, but not necessarily intended to change anything politically within the country. I'd like to bring Richard into this discussion. He has an article up on thetrumpet.com on this subject called The U.S. Airstrike on Syria and the Psalm 83 Alliance, bringing in prophecy and putting this in the context of what America has done through the Obama administration years and the weakness that the United States has shown with respect to Syria. How big of a change does this represent, really? I guess it's a little bit hard to say for sure, but maybe you could put this in a little bit of context for us, Richard, prophetically.
Right. So like you said, this is the first time that America has directly targeted Assad's regime. And you know, before Mr. Trump did this, you could just see, I just remember doing a 30-second news search, just looking, okay, what are some headlines about this? And they just seem to be all saying, well, this just shows how powerless America is. America said they were going to get rid of Assad's chemical weapons. Assad now just uses them with impunity. So it really does show that the failure of the past policy. And one of the things that we've talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio is, you know, this is the same people that were behind the fall of Mubarak in Egypt. And again, with Mubarak getting released, there was kind of a whole flurry of articles talking about the failure there. The same people behind the Iran nuke deal who are saying that they've gotten rid of Iran's nukes. Mm-hmm. They also said they got rid of Syria's chemical weapons. We've seen how that turned out. But it is, like you said, the first time an attack on Assad. So that is a change, of course. Now, I believe what they've said is that it is directly retributive, that this isn't the big, they've said, well, you know, it, the kind of the ball's in Assad's court. But if they don't respond and if he doesn't continue to use chemical weapons, this is a one-off. It's not the start of a kind of longer-term campaign.
Right.
However, A, that depends on Syria's response. But then also Donald Trump talked about – he was talking about how civilized nations of the world need to come together and stop this. So he is definitely talking in terms of a broader solution, in terms of perhaps getting rid of Assad. And Rex Tillerson made some quotes about getting rid of Assad. So you do – There is still, I think we still want some clarity, and perhaps Donald Trump hasn't decided exactly where he's going to go from here. But there's a lot building that looks like this could be the start of a much broader shift in America and a lot more pressure, certainly on Bashar al-Assad.
So because of the prophecies that we are really looking at, we know that Syria plays a very prominent role in a prophecy, and it's in the headline of your article, the Psalm 83 Alliance, that we expect a break between Syria and Iran. And we've been talking about, from the very beginning of the Syrian civil war, how removing Assad is basically the first domino that's going to break that alliance. And if there were enough action taken to weaken Assad's grip on power there, this could be the thing that causes this to finally tip over in that direction.
Yeah, it could well be. And as Brent brought out on his piece on Watch Jerusalem, and there's a lot of European support behind this. Like you mentioned, Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande, they signed a joint statement basically saying Assad had it coming and he needs to be stopped, you know, and basically indicating that we absolutely support this. You saw that's coming from Britain, perhaps more expected because there's a closer alliance there. But Europe, you see Europe absolutely on board with this, and you know, they're already involved within Syria. So many of these European powers, you've got Germany running reconnaissance missions, you've got France running bombing missions. So if this were to become a broader campaign, you could certainly see Europe supporting it and even getting involved, perhaps.
Brent, it in some ways, it seems like it's more about Europe's desire to see Assad removed than it is about their support for the United States. And the fact that they are even willing to show solidarity with Donald Trump shows just how much this really is what they're looking to see happen in Syria.
Yeah, this brings a whole host of issues for Europe to the fore. I mean, they don't want to agree with Mr. Trump, but if he is going to stop the cause of the migrant crisis. We know that Syria and that the Europe and Turkey right now, they're at an impasse, it seems, and Europe can't really do too much because Turkey is holding all these Syrian migrants, and at the cause of those Syrian migrants moving to Turkey is Assad. So it's in Europe's interest for Assad to go, for these Syrian refugees to then return from Turkey, from Lebanon, from Jordan, back to Syria, so that it removes that threat against Europe.
A lot of interest to watch here, and we'll definitely keep our eyes on it. It seems like this coming week could really say a lot. Exactly how does Syria respond, and how does the situation develop? So definitely keep us abreast of that. I'd encourage people to keep their eyes on thetrumpet.com as we put that in its prophetic context. We appreciate you gentlemen bringing that to us. Another big story on Monday at a metro station in the center of St. Petersburg, Russia. A nail bomb killed at least 11 people and injured dozens more. Who was behind the attack? How is the Russian government going to respond to this? For answers to these questions, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was it was a really barbaric attack carried out in the Karva train there in St. Petersburg, which is Russia's second largest city after Moscow. And the bomb was apparently a fairly crude device, but it was filled with nails just to be able to kill and wound as many people as possible. There was also a second bomb found nearby that did not detonate, which just shows that the attack was supposed to be far more deadly even than it was. And a couple of days after this happened, the bomber was identified as 22-year-old Akbarzhan Zalilov. He was a native of the Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan, which is a Muslim-majority country, and the Islamic State terrorist network is known to have a significant presence there, and a lot of other Islamic extremist groups as well. The Islamic State and these other Islamic extremists see a lot of those predominantly Muslim Central Asian states as sort of a prime recruiting ground for militants. So they have been just turning a lot of attention there. But the authorities don't yet know if the bomber was affiliated with the Islamic State or maybe with some other terrorist group. But they have arrested six other people, mostly from Kyrgyzstan, for possible connection with this attack. So there's still a lot that's unknown about this this really tragic and atrocious attack. But one thing that we can be sure of is that it will end up strengthening the grip and the power of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Now, before we talk about that, one thing that you mentioned in your article was just right before this attack, you had these propaganda pieces from ISIS saying we're going to come after Russia. So there has been there's definitely intent there. And this isn't the first time that the Islamic State has targeted Russia, if it does turn out to be coming from the Islamic State.
That's right. Yes. Just two or three months ago, the Islamic State issued some threats specifically at Vladimir Putin, saying that they would target him. And then just a few days before this attack, on social media, there was a pretty disturbing poster that was circulated by Islamic State affiliates or members just saying, we will burn Russia, something along those lines. So it really does seem to suggest Islamic State involvement, but it's not conclusive. The Islamic State issues a lot of threats. They publish a lot of threatening flyers and things like that and circulate them online as best as they can.
Well, what is their beef against Russia and Vladimir Putin?
Well, they don't like what he's doing in Syria. You know, they don't appreciate his support of the Assad regime that we talked about in the first story there, which directly threatens ISIS's power in Syria.
Yeah.
So that's a huge part of it. And so the Islamic State certainly does have plenty of motivation to target Russia and Putin.
So in this article, you talk about the effect that whenever these types of things happen, basically it gives the president the latitude that he needs in order to tighten his grip.
Yeah, that's right. You could really say that Putin's iron grip has been forged in the fires of terrorism. There's a really powerful Stratfor article with the title somewhere along those lines. And it's really fascinating if you look at this. It's actually since the very beginning of his reign, Putin has been able to use terrorism to boost his power. And even before he was the leader of Russia, back in 1999, when Boris Yeltsin was the Russian leader, there were a series of terrible apartment bombings in Moscow. They killed hundreds of people, and Chechen militants ended up claiming those attacks. But the Russians were just starving for security. They were terrified. And Putin pledged to give them that security. And within 3 months, Yeltsin had resigned early and Putin had become the acting president. And a lot of analysts say that Putin never would have come to power had those apartment bombings not happened. Mm-hmm. And there's even some compelling theories about Putin and the FSB being secretly responsible for those attacks that brought Putin to power. But whether or not that was the case, Putin's response to those attacks made the Russians view him as a real, almost a savior type figure. And his sudden popularity gave him all kinds of power. So he started to make huge reforms in Russia. But then about 4 years went by, his popularity was dipping quite a bit. But then along came another big spate of terrorist attacks. There were two Russian planes shot out of the sky mid-flight. There was a bombing in a Moscow subway. And then there was that terrible thing that happened in the primary school there, where hostages were taken. It ended up killing 385 people, I think, including about 200 children. Mm-hmm. And so that spate of attacks marked another huge turning point for Putin. Once again, he was seen as the only way to protect Russia from more of these kinds of attacks. And so the people rallied behind him like never before. He was able to push through some major laws, just restricting media, restricting various companies. He also boosted the power of Russia's state security services, and he broadened the definition of terrorism in a way that gave him the ability to suppress a lot of his political opponents. And around the same time, he gave himself the power to appoint regional leaders, and he realigned some other aspects of Russia's government in a way that basically put all of Russia's power at his disposal. And so it's thanks to terrorism that he was able to really make himself an autocrat or a dictator in Russia. And almost every time another major terrorist attack has happened in Russia, it has served to boost his power a little bit more.
So we'll keep our eyes peeled to see how what his response is in the wake of these attacks this last week, and see if he follows the pattern that we've seen in the past. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. While we're talking about terrorist attacks in Sweden, this morning a truck smashed into a store in central Stockholm, killing at least three people and injuring several more. We're going to get an update on what has happened here from our Europe analyst, Richard.
Yes, this is still, this has just happened within the last few hours as we're recording this. A lot of details unknown. I think some of the latest reports are now saying perhaps five dead. There's still a lot of clarity there. With it being a truck ramming, I would probably expect more fatalities to come in as we know more, and this to perhaps be more deadly than that St. Petersburg bombing earlier in the week. So what it looked like happened is that there was a beer truck that was hijacked during a delivery to a restaurant. Then somebody drove that down a pedestrianized street. There were some reports saying that they drove for several blocks before smashing it into a department store. I've got some quotes from eyewitnesses here. Someone said there's total confusion. Many people are left totally shocked. Someone else said, I saw hundreds of people run. They ran for their lives. I turned and ran as well. An article states bloodstains were visible on the streets, along with bodies covered in blankets in the aftermath of the incident in the busy shopping district. So just a brutal, but a brutally familiar attack, someone stealing a truck. The Sweden's prime minister has called it a terror attack. So it does seem, they obviously know something about the motivation behind it, and it is a terrorist attack. There are reports as well of shots fired. I would be skeptical of that at this point, because it seems like there are always reports. Well, it doesn't seem like there are always reports of shots fired. There are always reports of a second shooter. But there are still those reports. And so the police have cleared out the city center. They've shut down the station, the main station that was near there. So it does look like we just had yet another of these attacks in Europe.
Yeah, it really has become common in several European countries to see these things. And We'll keep abreast of that situation as well. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review on 101.3 KPCG. And before we move on from Richard, we're going to give him the opportunity to talk about one more story. The German military is launching a new branch, the Cyber and Information Space Command. This shows just how much Germany is recognizing the threat posed from cyber attacks. So back to Richard for this story.
That's right. Germany has a cyber general now, Lieutenant General Ludwig Leinhaus. Though he will eventually head a team of 13,500 computer specialists. It's a sixth branch to the German military. So
that's a lot of computer specialists, 13,500.
Right. Yeah, this is a big deal. You know, it's not like they're opening an office somewhere or they've got a room full of a few people as part of the army, which is a bit like what they had before. It's a full branch led by a lieutenant general. I mean, they're really taking it seriously. Just the foundation of that, I think, is really significant. But then while the German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, was kind of presiding over the opening ceremonies for this new branch, she said that they had the authority to respond with offensive measures. So we're looking at a cyber command that doesn't just try to protect and defend German security, but will be training, looking for, creating offensive uses for cyber warfare. And that's a big deal. Now, she did say that it was that would be in response to an attack. I mean, but the techniques of cyber offense are the same whether you're responding to an attack or not. They're going to be training for offensive cyber warfare. And there is some question as to whether that's legal under the German constitution. She certainly feels that she has that authority. That's quite a dramatic step up in cyber warfare for Germany.
This is a headline that I think anyone who's been reading the Trumpet for a long time, you immediately think of that headline from back in 2005 from Gerald Fleury, America's Achilles heel and Germany, where he was talking about America's susceptibility and vulnerability to cyber attack, but specifically talking about the threat posed from Germany. You can't help but think about that when you see what Germany is doing here.
That's right. And it's and even that, I think, was an update of an article from the 1990s. So it's something that Mr. Fari has been talking about right from the start. And that's it was very specific. America has this Achilles heel. And that's something that we've seen more and more people talking about as the years have gone by. America's dependence upon computer systems, upon network systems, and you know how that's a huge vulnerability. And I think it's fairly you see that a lot now in the mainstream press. Less so back when he wrote it. But now you see Germany really looking at becoming a premier nation, kind of entering the big leagues when it comes to cyber warfare. I'd say now you're looking at America, obviously, with the NSA. They have a strong focus on that. Britain with GCHQ, the Russians, obviously, the Chinese, and now Germany. And that's kind of the league that they're playing in, I think, with the opening up of this big new cyber command.
If you're interested in more information on this article, this subject, go to thetrumpet.com and read the article, Germany Prepares for a New Dimension in Warfare. It's written by trumpet writer Josue Michels, a German. He's reporting on his fatherland there. It does link to that article from Gerald Fleury back in 2005, America's Achilles Heel and Germany. Go check it out. We appreciate that, Richard. Both of those stories, important stuff there. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. You probably remember the videos that came out a couple years ago where there were people secretly filming conversations with Planned Parenthood officials. They were talking about selling aborted baby parts and really gruesome and shocking discussions. These abortion clinic employees just rummaging around through plates of scattered fetal body parts and talking about what price each of these little pieces would go for. This is a federal offense. Well, now justice has been served. The state of California ruled on the case, and, well, the outcome is just about as gut-wrenching as the videos themselves. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is a story that really should be shocking, even though it kind of isn't, just that we've gotten so used to this type of thing coming from the American justice system today. But like I said, you'll remember the like I said, the videos of these Planned Parenthood employees, just like I said, rummaging through body parts, talking about what they'll sell, talking about committing a federal offense, never prosecuted for any of this. And now the state of California has actually gone a step beyond that and decided to prosecute the people who leaked the video for a violation of privacy charges. They said it's obviously that these Planned Parenthood employees were being filmed without their knowledge, which technically is a crime that they have decided to prosecute. It's kind of like one of those you strain at a gnat but swallow a camel type scenarios that they're like, all right, well, you committed a crime for filming them, so wherefore we're going to prosecute and arrest you for this, even though they committed a crime for trafficking human body parts, and we're not going to do anything about that.
It's phenomenal.
And so it's, this is the state of California, so, I mean, we'll see how high up in the appellate levels this type of thing gets, though I suspect not too far. We've got an article in our editor's pick up on the Trumpet website, thetrumpet.com right now, by Sam Livingston. And he actually has a quote towards the end where he's actually he's quoting Mr. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, from the No Freedom Without Law booklet about a prophecy in Micah, where this prophecy in Micah is about the upside down justice system in the end time. This verse even talks about, he says, You hate the good and you love the evil. You pluck off the skin from them and the flesh from their bones. You also eat the flesh of my people and flay their skins from them. And I will break their bones and chop them into pieces as for the pot, as for the flesh of a cauldron. And I think in that verse, that's really just this talking they bring out in that booklet, how that in some ways that's talking about just some of the underhanded business practices they have in America. But then also, this is just like a really real like fulfillment of that verse, where you've got an upside down justice system where you're literally flaying fresh from bones and selling it for profit, and yet the judges of the nation have no problems or qualms with that type of behavior.
Very, very gruesome, very disturbing. And I think you're straining at the gnat and swallowing the camel analogy is very apropos. This is just a terrible indictment of how unjust the justice system in America really is. And we appreciate you bringing that to us. And do go to thetrumpet.com and read that article from Sam Livingston. Not a very long article, but quite a powerful article. And you can find it on thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about China's leader visiting Donald Trump, a surprising announcement from Russia's foreign ministry, the difficult issue of what happens to Gibraltar now that Britain is leaving the European Union, and a record-breaking drug bust in Australia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
During the presidential campaign last year, Donald Trump had a lot of harsh words for China. He said the country was raping the U.S. He complained about terrible trade deficits and job losses. Well, now he's president, and this week he hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping at his resort in Florida. Not exactly the makings for a comfortable, amicable visit. But to learn what they talked about and how it went, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, right now, Mr. Xi is actually in Florida. It was a two-day series of meetings with President Trump held at Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago retreat there. And the two are talking about trade. They're talking about the one China policy between China and Taiwan. They're talking about Mr. Trump's decision to carry out the airstrike on Syria that we talked about in the first half there. But probably the highest item on the agenda is nuclear-armed North Korea. North Korea is in the headlines more and more these days because under Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, the nation has become steadily more belligerent and just less predictable all the time. Just on Wednesday, the North Koreans fired yet another missile into the Sea of Japan. And North Korea has also been pledging and steadily working to create an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of hitting the west coast of America. And so all of these illegal weapons tests and threats are adding quite a lot of uncertainty to the Korean Peninsula and just to Asia in general. And as we've discussed on the Trumpet Hour before, China is the main reason why North Korea has been able to survive for so long. The Chinese have been supporting this lunatic regime to varying degrees for many years now. But at the Mar-a-Lago meetings underway right now, President Trump is calling on Xi Jinping to put some serious pressure on North Korea just to make it halt that illegal nuclear weapons program and its illegal missile program. Mr. Trump is asking Xi to deny North Korea access to some banking institutions, and he's asking Xi to apply pressure on North Korea in some other ways, too. But Mr. Trump recently said that if China is not going to solve the North Korean problem, then the United States will do it alone with unilateral action. So that could become a really sensitive topic for Mr. Trump and Xi.
And we've been talking about this THAAD missile system that they're setting up in South Korea. There's already been a certain amount of effort that the United States has put toward dealing with this, and obviously China hasn't been supportive of that. So that there's already a little bit of muscle behind the rhetoric at this point.
That's right. Yes, the THAAD system is in the process of being set up right now, and that just infuriates China. They view it as a U.S. measure to sort of contain Chinese power. And then also this week, there was an extraordinary statement issued by the Trump administration after that missile test happened, the missile that flew into the Sea of Japan. Just after that, Rex Tillerson, Mr. Trump's Secretary of State and also the top diplomat in America, he said, quote, "North Korea launched yet another intermediate range ballistic missile. The United States has spoken enough about North Korea. We have no further comment," end quote. 23 words, if you're counting. 23 pretty ambiguous words in a lot of ways. This is a very enigmatic statement, and it came very shortly after the U.S. said that it would even consider a preemptive strike on North Korea in order to halt those illegal programs. So that really raised the temperature of the whole situation there. And this is America's top diplomat. You know, diplomats normally talk. Their job is to talk, but also to find solutions to thorny issues that go beyond just rhetoric. But this statement was very terse, and a lot of onlookers were just very worried. 23 enigmatic words. So anyway, in response to that, North Korea said that it would carry out a preemptive strike of its own if there's even a slight suggestion that the U.S. is carrying out a preemptive strike. So all of these threats have really concerned a lot of onlookers, and that's why Mr. Trump is trying to ramp up pressure on China to make China apply pressure on North Korea right now.
China deals with the problem, then it takes a lot of the pressure off the United States and dials the temperature of the whole situation down.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. And meanwhile, this week in South Korea, a man named Moon Jae-in emerged as the clear front runner in the presidential race, which will be voted on in May 9th, I think it is. And Mr. Moon, it's a fascinating development because Mr. Moon is far more pro-China and anti-America, anti-THAAD system than the previous administration was. So this transition, now that it looks like I think he's got a 10-point lead in the polls, it looks almost certain that he'll be the next president. And this transition in South Korea is a real boon to China and quite a bane for American presence in the region.
Well, I saw very early on, I guess, Donald Trump saying, you know, "We welcome you to Florida." And he said, he was kind of joking, you know, people laughed at it, but he said, "I've gotten absolutely nothing out of Xi Jinping at this meeting. But you do have to wonder, well, what sort of leverage does the United States really have in this situation? If we're really kind of losing ground with the administration in South Korea, or certainly looks like that's the way that the wind is blowing there, you know, how much does Donald Trump really have to hold against Mr. Xi?
You know, I actually think that the strikes in Syria boost U.S. leverage quite a bit. That will be something that really makes North Korea and even China and Iran, I think, take note and say, we're dealing with a different administration here than the Obama administration. This is a United States that's prepared to back up its words with actions.
Yeah, you could see that, and at the same time, you do wonder how deep does that resolve go? I mean, in this, you're talking about, say, one set of strikes on a very targeted place in Syria. You know, how much stomach does America have for anything that would be, you know, larger than that? And if you see that happening in, I mean, you could see it both ways, but if America commits that kind of action in Syria, well, how much is it going to want to do that again in North Korea and in other theaters? Andrew, you had a comment.
Yeah, because that's a tricky thing to when dealing with China like this, is that since they don't have elections that they're looking at winning every 4 years, they definitely think very long term. And I've seen a couple of the documents where they've Chinese policymakers, they've done the math on population growth, and they've done the math on economic growth, and they've done the math on all these long-term factors, and they realize that on the 50-year range, Chinese supremacy is almost inevitable.
Right.
I think they said even Western institutions will say that Asia will control 50% of the world's gross domestic product by mid-century. Mm. And so he may have to, I don't know, maybe he will give in a little bit if he's got a more aggressive president who he'll be rid of in 8 years.
Yeah, but they can afford to be patient.
But they can afford to be patient.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that. We'll keep our eyes on that as well. We've been talking a lot lately about Russia's interventions in the Middle East and Northern Africa, not to mention Southern Asia and Eastern Europe. Vladimir Putin has really positioned his nation as a major player in international relations, and a lot of that has come at America's expense. Well, Thursday, the Russian Foreign Ministry issued a surprising statement. It represented quite a bold step in its Middle East policy. Very interesting move here. And for this, we're going to go back to our Middle East man, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was quite surprising, as you said, and maybe initially it was to deflect some of the blame on Russia for what happened in Syria from the Assad regime. But we don't really know what prompted it, but they sent out a announcement on Thursday, the Russian Foreign Ministry, in which they declared that right now they see Jerusalem, or at least West Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel. This is the first state outside Israel that has declared any part of Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel, the Jewish state, which was completely surprising. I mean, diplomats are going to be talking with the Russians, Israeli diplomats, this week, exactly what they meant by this. The announcement itself was couched in terms of, in the peace deal coming up, we're going to have East Jerusalem being the capital of the Palestinians, and therefore it must be said, they said, that West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
So that's interesting. I mean, first of all, the fact that it's kind of acknowledging that there is a peace deal coming up and that there is going to be a Palestinian state recognized at some point. But still, this is the first country in the world, right, that has actually acknowledged any aspect of Jerusalem being a capital of Israel.
Right. I mean, the reason is it goes back to the Oslo Accords back in 1993, when Jerusalem was to be a separate issue that was to be worked out between Palestinians and Israelis about how it was going to figure it out, whether we're going to have a division, East Jerusalem be capital of the Palestinian state, West Jerusalem be capital of the Israeli state, whether we're going to have Jerusalem being an internationally governed city where Palestinians and Israelis could go, and yet there would be some UN body in charge of it or not. And that's kind of where we've been. And Russia has come out, I believe, in response to well, at least following on the resolution late last year, which did declare East Jerusalem the capital of the Palestinian state, and said, well, if that's the case now, if we've acknowledged that, then what's the difference, or what's the big deal acknowledging that West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel?
What's Russia after here? I mean, this seems like, you know, we talk a lot about the relationship with Iran. We talk a lot about Russia's relationship and how much it's propped up Bashar Assad. You know, its Middle East policy has really not been strongly pro-Israel by any stretch, although there has been, you know, quite a lot of diplomatic going back and forth between Israel and Russia over different issues. What's Russia after here?
I'm not sure. Their relationship with Israel has been better than America's relationship with Russia. It has, in terms of Israel, they think very realistically as to what's going to be in my nation's best interest. And they looked at Syria with the United States that was unwilling to act, at least until this week, and they saw Russia and Iran. Russia and Iran. And over the past 3 or 4 months, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has petitioned Russia to grow in power in Syria to remove Iranian influence because they see Iran being the more negative character there as far as Israeli security is concerned. So there has been a closer relationship between the two, but that doesn't really necessitate Russia doing favors for Israel. We just have to look back until the Soviet era times when the Soviet Union supported numerous Arab states in the fight against Israel, both in the Yom Kippur War, both in the Six-Day War. It was Russian arms that were backing Syria and Egypt in those fights against Israel. They do not like Israel. So what are they doing? I think this is kind of a carrot and stick approach in a way where it looks like this is going to be a benefit for Israel, for them declaring West Jerusalem the capital. But in the end, Israelis want all Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Israelis annexed all Jerusalem in 1980. They want to unify Jerusalem. They don't want to divide the city, most Israeli citizens, including the government. So while this could be seen as a positive, really, it's just making it more or solidifying what the UN resolution said. We are going to have two states for two people. And as far as Russia's concerned, hey, it's already happening right now.
I can't help but just view this as some kind of effort to undercut or at least insert itself into this situation. As America, the talk of reviving negotiations and America trying to bring about a peace deal and so on. It's just amazing to me how many of these different situations we're talking about Russia. You know, we're talking about Russia with respect to the Balkans and Libya. We were talking about Afghanistan this last week, and here Israel. They're all over the place, not to mention everywhere that they're engaged in Eastern Europe and so on. It's really extraordinary.
Yeah, I do believe that you are onto something there. Even other parts of this statement did talk about Russia's desire to be part of a solution going forward, just as Trump seems to be ramping up his own efforts. And apparently Russia wants a seat at that table as well.
Thanks for that, Brent. Well, last week we talked about Britain submitting the legal paperwork to begin divorcing itself from the European Union. And, of course, this is a process that promises to bring a lot of hassles and difficulties. Well, one of those difficulties reared its head immediately. That is the status of Gibraltar, this little bit of land right at the southern tip of Spain that is a British overseas territory. European Council made clear that it's going to play hardball with Britain. And to learn about how, we're going to go back to our British correspondent, Richard Palmer.
That's right. We had a leak of, or at least a release of the European Council's draft guidelines for the Brexit negotiations. And these guidelines state that after the United Kingdom leaves the Union, no agreement between the EU and the United Kingdom may apply to the territory of Gibraltar without the agreement between the Kingdom of Spain and the United Kingdom. So it gives Spain a say over the status of Gibraltar and exactly what is going on there. And it's something Gibraltar is not very happy about. One of the chief legal officers for the Gibraltar's government said in practical terms it means Spain could block Gibraltar's access to any trade deal which the UK may negotiate with the EU, things escalated pretty quickly once that walked out, or that came out, and you had Lord Howard, the former leader of the Conservative Party, on TV basically hinting that we would go to war with Spain over this, and now it's already become a very divisive issue.
This gives you a pretty good indication, it seems like, how difficult Europe intends to make this for Britain. If they're putting up this kind of a stink over this issue, how does this affect the negotiations and everywhere else?
Right, the stink over this issue this quickly. I mean, we're barely a week. I think that came out just days after Britain officially submitted Article 50. The Guardian had a quote from an EU diplomat. They didn't name them. But the quote said, Spain are taking this very, very seriously. I think there is support across the board among the EU member states. Why not? He said, "No, this problem has been with us for a long time. We've always listened to both sides. Now we are going to support the member state. That is the philosophy behind it. I wouldn't think that any of the other 28 states will somehow try to undermine this clause. So, okay, well, you're not part of the European Union anymore. Well, that means we automatically take Spain's side." And so you can just see this now getting played out with any dispute between the UK and a European Union member. Well, we're just going to take the EU member's side on this one and on this one and on this one. So
right, and in this case, you're talking about really directly going against the desires of the people of Gibraltar, and basically using them as a pawn in these negotiations with Britain, to unconcerned about their welfare at all, or what their expectations are.
That's right. It's been a big. It's very hypocritical because the European Union has been going around saying, "Well, don't use say European citizens within Britain and their residency status, don't use them as pawns in this negotiation, don't let them be held hostage," while they're then doing exactly the same thing to Gibraltar.
Well, we will see what happens in those negotiations. We appreciate you talking about that, Richard. We're going to finish with a story about a huge drug bust in Australia, a record-breaking bust. We're going to hear about this from Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this was actually the largest drug bust ever in Australia. They found a full 1 ton of crystal methamphetamines in a suburb of Melbourne. It's actually the equivalent of like 9 million individual drug hits for individual drug users, and has a street value of almost $750 million. We've got an article that will be going up on the by the Trumpet soon by Callum Wood on that topic, and he just brings out some really shocking statistics that this particular crate, their police believe, came from a cartel in Asia instead of the Mexican cartels that probably can share a larger portion of the Australian drug market. But he says there's up to roughly 270,000 regular meth addicts there, which is triple the amount as it was just 6 years ago.
Wow.
So that's 6 years ago. So that's almost like Australia's version of what they're experiencing in America with the heroin crisis or the opioid crisis. Is, you know, here in the United States, since marijuana has been legalized, the drug cartels have tried to move more into the heroin market, and we've actually seen heroin addiction rates and heroin death rates double and triple in some cases over the past decade. And then here in, especially in Eastern Australia, you're seeing a similar thing with the methamphetamines, where you have literally like three times more people who are addicted to these than they were just so few years ago that you could count them on both hands.
It's a terrible, terrible problem. If you want to learn more about this, you can read the article that'll be going up on thetrumpet.com and just within the next day or two. Australian police net record-breaking drug bust. It's written by Trumpet writer Callum Wood, and really just talks about how the cause of this problem. Obviously, if the demand is there, the supply is going to keep on coming in. One drug bust isn't going to solve the problem, but check it out on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com, and you can read about that drug bust story and everything else that we've talked about on the program today. Pretty much you'll find articles on those at thetrumpet.com with links to things that we've said in the past and showing all of these events in their prophetic context. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news that's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Brent.
Israel Hayom reported this week that Mazen Fuka, the Hamas official killed last month in Gaza, planned to turn the upcoming Passover holiday into a bloodbath for Israelis. Israeli defense officials believe that the attacks that Hamas was going to perpetrate over the week included abduction of Israeli soldiers or civilians in order to force Israel to release hundreds of Palestinian security prisoners that weren't included in the last deal back when Gilad Shalit was released. This man that was killed, this Hamas official, he was released in the Shalit prisoner exchange back in 2011 when 1,027 prisoners were released from Israeli prisons and they were collectively responsible for the murder of 569 Israelis for the return, of course, of that one Israeli soldier. Defense officials also said as part of that report that they believe that 50% of those released in 2011 are currently involved in terrorist activities.
Hmm. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte on Thursday ordered Philippine troops to occupy uninhabited islands and shoals that the Philippines claims in the South China Sea. So it looks like the firebrand president may have had a change of heart about giving all of those territories to China. In the past, he's basically given in to China and all of its ridiculous territorial claims in the South China Sea. But Duterte is now asserting Philippine sovereignty in a way that's likely to anger Beijing.
Over to Andrew.
The United States Senate voted Thursday to invoke the nuclear option and scrap the filibuster on Supreme Court nominees, seeing as the Democratic Party had pledged to filibuster the nomination of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. This rule change will allow Gorsuch to be nominated as the next Supreme Court justice with a simple majority.
All right, over to Brent.
The end of the Islamic State's hold on its capital, the Syrian city of Raqqa, is becoming more and more a reality. The Financial Times reported this week that there are about 2,000 fighters remaining in the city, but administrative officials are fleeing with their families to safer territory. One ISIS fighter reported ammunition shortages and foreign fighters that were fleeing as well. Most of them are fleeing or being relocated to the province of Deir ez-Zor, which is towards the Iraqi border, which will further shrink Islamic State's territorial holdings.
All right, now to Richard.
There are signs of a growing divide between Germany and America, especially Germany's Social Democrats, a major contender at the upcoming election. This week, the German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel rejected a lot of what U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has said. Tillerson demanded a clear outline from NATO members how they plan to spend 2% of their annual budget on the military. And Tillerson kind of made fun of that and said, Gabriel made fun of that, saying, well, I don't even know where we would put all the aircraft carriers. Now, Germany's government is more in favor of this, but the divide of increasing the military, but the divide does show this quite different thinking between Germany and the United States.
All right, back to Jeremiah.
If you're pregnant with a baby girl and you're in India, you can have the baby delivered for free. There are now 17,000 Indian obstetricians and other doctors who will deliver baby girls free of charge. It's part of increasing efforts in India to challenge sexism that is deeply entrenched in parts of society. And this initiative is a pretty new one, but those participating in it say that it's already having an impact in changing society's misogynistic views.
And one more time to Brent.
You've heard of Iron Dome, the short-range missile defense system that was so important for Israel in the 2014 war against Hamas, where it shot down about 4,000 of Hamas's rockets. Well, on Sunday, Israel unveiled its latest addition to its multi-level missile defense system with one called David's Sling. And this is designed to intercept medium-range missiles, particularly those of Hezbollah, who has larger rockets that can travel much further distances.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
If you live in Dallas, Texas, you may be able to get a robot to mow your lawn this weekend. Dallas lawn care startup Robin has installed up to 50 robotic lawn mowers in North Texas, with plans to roll out 50 to 100 more every month. The ultimate goal is to provide consumers with an option to actually have robots mow their lawn so they would not have to spend the time to do it themselves or hire someone else to do it for them.
Sounds kind of nice. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories we talked about on the program today. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of George Bernard Shaw. Better keep yourself clean and bright. You are the window through which you must see the world. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.